So I don't have focus, I don't think. Or maybe I was hitting the wrong, there it goes. I may have been hitting the wrong button. That's happened once or twice in my life. I have to check back. There was a book I ran across about the healing power of storytelling that was a really interesting book. It was written by a doctor who came down with a chronic disease herself early in her practice, and for a while really didn't share that she was dealing that with the folks she worked with, or that she, with patients typically. And she came to a point of recognizing that she could be a much better provider when two things happen. She could be a much better provider when she listened to the story of her patients fully and understood where they were. And as they understood her story at times, when it related to the issue that they were facing, in particular, that had benefit. And she, so this book, The Healing Power of Storytelling, was just an interesting book. But this was an excerpt that she just said that the majority of Americans don't make decisions on data, no matter how abundant or compelling it may be. They make up their mind because of stories. So Oprah didn't fill her particular show with PowerPoint slides and graphs. Instead, she had a real person on the couch tell a story. And folks connected. Folks listened to that story and had a connection there. It's just part of that premise that so often stories connect with us powerfully and can impact us in different ways. And I wanted to share a story, a short reading that I ran across years ago, and it's just always kind of stood out for me. It's a short essay by a gentleman named G.W. Target. And he wrote, "Two men, both seriously ill, occupied the same small hospital room. One man was allowed to sit up in his bed for an hour each afternoon to help drain the fluid from his lungs. His bed was next to the room's only window. The other man had to spend all his time flat on his back. The men talked for hours on end. They spoke of their wives and families, their homes, their jobs, their involvement in the military service, where they'd both gone on vacation. And every afternoon, when the man in the bed by the window could sit up, he would pass the time by describing to his roommate all the things he could see outside the window. The man in the other bed began to live for those one-hour periods where his world would be broadened and enlivened by all the activity and color of the outside world. The window overlooked a park with a lovely lake, the man said. Ducks and swans played on the water while children sailed their model boats. Lovers walked arm in arm amid flowers of every color of the rainbow. Grand old trees graced the landscape, and a fine view of the city could be seen in the distance. As the man by the window described all this in exquisite detail, the man on the other side of the room would close his eyes and imagine the picturesque scene. One warm afternoon, the man by the window described a parade passing by. Although the other man could not hear the band, he could see it in his mind's eyes as the gentleman by the window portrayed it with descriptive words. Unexpectedly, an alien thought entered his head. Why should he have all the pleasures of seeing everything while I never get to see anything? It just doesn't seem fair. As the thought fermented, the man felt ashamed at first. But as the days passed and he missed seeing more sights, his envy eroded into resentment and soon turned him sour. He began to brood and found himself unable to sleep. He should be the one by the window. The thought now controlled his life. Late one night, as he lay staring at the ceiling, the man by the window began to cough. He was choking on the fluid in his lungs. The other man watched in the dimly lit room as the struggling man by the window groped for the button to call for help. Listening from across the room, he never moved, never pushed his own call button which would have brought the nurse running, and in less than 5 minutes, the coughing and choking stopped, along with the sound of breathing. Now there was only silence, deadly silence. The following morning, the day nurse arrived to bring water for their baths. When she found the lifeless body of the man by the window, she was saddened and called the hospital attendants to take it away. No words, no fuss. As soon as it seemed appropriate, the other man asked if he could be moved next to the window. The nurse was happy to make the switch, and after making sure he was comfortable, she left him alone. Slowly, painfully, he propped himself up on one elbow to take his first look. Finally, he would have the joy of seeing it all himself. He strained to look out the window beside the bed. It faced a blank wall. It's just one of those poignant kind of stories as you realize what was going on, as you realize it wasn't what it seemed at first at all. And that perception really drove a difference. So stepping back, what's the central message that comes from that story? How does that strike you? Or what do you get out of that?
Counting blessings.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that was by that blank wall was going out of his way to try and give hope and encourage. Yeah. Other thoughts or reflections about the message that's there. We can allow envy and bitterness to rob us of our greatest blessings. I was trying to remember a quote that one of the students had said a couple of weeks ago, and I think the quote was, "Comparison is the thief of joy," and just that idea that sometimes when we focused on thinking, "Why does that other person seem to have it so much better than me?" it can steal the joy that we can have. It isn't. We can have this perception. We can have a perception that the grass is greener, but it's not necessarily the case. It is interested there. What made, and just thinking about how stories connect, what elements made that story work? What about it makes it connect with us? Anything that you think of? It does. It's turned upside down. Any other things that make it relate?
When you're a kid, open that Christmas present and get socks.
And you've thought all along, this is a transformer. This is whatever the amazing toy is. Yeah. In this story, in a part of each of the stories, each of the parables we see, each of the things in Scripture, it often begins with this gentle entrance, if you will, non-confrontational, not something that we're going to stumble over, and we get wrapped into it. It's as if we find ourselves in the midst of the story and can relate. We can relate to the one who longs to see outside, and the one who's getting to see these amazing things and sharing it, and that disparity a little bit between the two that doesn't seem quite fair, and then as Ray's saying, that element that, as Malcolm Gladwell had said, our expectations are betrayed. We thought it was going down one way, we thought we understood, and all of a sudden we realize the truth is far different than it seemed in the first part of the story, or that there's something we didn't take, weren't aware of, or didn't take into account. Just that in that case, reality wasn't what drove the man away from the window's behavior. If he could have acted on reality, he would have tried to save his friend, who was working day after day to be an encourager, to try and lift him up. He was not driven by reality, but he was driven by a perception that did not match reality. And that piece for us is that it happens with us, doesn't it, at times, that we can be driven by, we can be convinced of something, of a perception, and that can drive our behavior. When Paul said that we needed to test the spirits and we need to examine ourselves, it was for good reason. Because it's easy for us to believe something convenient, take something we want to hear, and especially in today's days of social media, of Google searches giving us what it looks like we would be interested in seeing, that we can find ourselves folks that tickle our ears, tell us things that align with our thoughts, and only reinforce something that may not be wholly true, wholly factual. It's just a cautionary things. We've got to take the time to try and understand the truth, lest we find when we look out a window eventually that it faces a brick wall when we thought it was something totally, totally different. Yeah. What a difference that made. He did. He did. He thought the world was on. He was thinking the world was unfair to him, and he needed to set it right. Well, this encountering undeniable truth is where we're going with this, like that man who finally looked out the window and realized an undeniable truth. He realized his world was not what he thought. And we'll be looking in 1 Kings, starting in chapter 16, look in detail in chapter 18, but looking at the setup for this, we're reading about the period in which Ahab became the king of Israel, and he was to reign for 22 years. In 1 Kings 16 and verse 30, there is a comment. It's not one you want on your resume, not one I want on my resume, about he did more evil than any other king who had ever been. It's just there had been some folks who had been not good before Ahab, but to be known as, yeah, this is the worst of the worst, that's a hard thing. He married Jezebel, the daughter of the king of the Sidonians, and he set up altars to false gods, to Baal, set up an Asherah pole, set up altars to false gods, and did not, when he had the opportunity to help lead God's children spiritually, he didn't keep them focused on God and the truth. He went in the opposite direction of taking them away from him. There was a drought that came and impacted Israel for several years. And we'll see later that Elijah was involved in that drought, both in the start and the finish. Elijah was on the scene, and during that drought, he was fed by ravens. God provided food for him. We think about drones delivering food today, not something necessarily new. You know, I don't know if those ravens, you know, if they brought a hamburger and fries in a bag, I'd kind of doubt it. But in some way or another, these ravens would come and bring him food. I just think that's amazing. And though there was a drought, God had let Elijah know, here is a brook that's going to have water. You need to hang by here and you'll be taken care of. And it was during this time that Elijah encounters this widow of Zarephath, she's the one that was cooking her very last meal. And she had just a little bit of oil and just a little bit of flour. And he asked her to trust him and to share it with him. And if she would, that she would not run out of food. She would not run out of oil or flour. And that's indeed what happened. That widow's son died, and Elijah raises him from the dead in this period of time. So God's at work. God's at work in different ways through Elijah while Ahab's leading the nation the wrong way. But in the third year of the drought, when things were, you imagine, I mean, a drought for a few months can be rough. A drought for a year can be hard. A drought for 3 years can be devastating in terms of pastures or livestock or grain or anything you want. But in the third year of the drought, Elijah's told by God, go see Ahab. Oh. And that's where we pick up in 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 16, where we read, so Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. And when he saw Elijah, he said to him, this is King Ahab greeting Elijah. And what's the greeting Ahab gives? Is that you? You troublemaker, you troubler of Israel. You find that interesting that Ahab, that put up the idols, who led the people away, says, is that you, you trouble of Israel? Why do you think Ahab calls Elijah that? Does that... Yeah. He is. What I want, it's ironic in a sense that the real troubler of Israel, the one who's causing the problems, the one who led them astray, and I'd say led to there being a drought, was calling somebody else. He knew Israel was in trouble, but he couldn't accept any of the blame on his own. Couldn't accept any of the responsibility. And it's a reminder that sometimes it's so easy for me to think it's their fault, it's somebody else's fault, instead of seeing maybe it's me, maybe it's something that I shouldn't have done or should take care of or do differently. And he seems to be living his life casting blame on others. Elijah responds, I've not made trouble for Israel, Elijah replied, but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned me, abandoned the Lord's commands, and have followed the Baals. And then Elijah, after directly responding to Ahab's charge, false charge, Elijah says, now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel. Bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. I don't know how big that table was. I mean, I just think about both of them. Baal, who put up the false idols for folks to worship. Jezebel, who was fostering this, who was welcoming and facilitating these false prophets to be right there amongst the leadership of the kingdom. Elijah's just not gonna deal with it. He confronts it directly. If I'd been Elijah, I might have been more tempted to say, okay, you pick one and we'll have some competition one-on-one. But I think it's interesting, noteworthy to see, he says, bring them all. Bring these 850 to stand at Mount Carmel, and we'll find out. That's striking for me.
What's really striking is then after he defeats them, he becomes scared.
Yeah, that what happens later on.
Fearful.
But at this point where he is standing strong, it's before he gets to that part of the struggle, he is able to be confident. This passage that Paul wrote in Romans, that's at the end of that beautiful chapter, Romans chapter 8, that Paul said, what shall we say to these things? If God's for us, who can be against us? That I see Elijah as exemplifying that passage at this juncture, that he's saying, it doesn't matter how many you've got. God, I know that I'm on the side of God, and that's enough. And that's enough to stand up against anyone in any group that's there. So Ahab goes throughout the land of Israel, and he gets all the prophets, these 850 prophets on Mount Carmel. And Elijah went before the people, and he Elijah's words to people. Can you kind of imagine this gathering? Probably a lot more than the 850 folks, but at least 850, at least Ahab and some of his folks there. And Elijah is speaking out, shouting, expect where they can hear him. He says, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, you follow him. Was that the first time a challenge like that has gone out in Scripture? Do you think of any other challenges like that that have gone out? About to choose you this day whom you will serve, Joshua. But as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Yeah. Israel had been challenged like this before, and they just hadn't stuck with it. And Elijah is saying, you've got to make a choice. I think about that and this question of when do we have to choose? They had delayed making a choice, or they were following multiple deities at that time. Elijah's trying to force the hand and said, this isn't right. You have to make a choice. Is there a time that we need to choose? Every day? As soon as this comes up in our life, we need to start making that choice. Not a one of us knows when will be our last day. Thursday night, we at Lipscomb, for the group I'm involved with, we had our seniors together. They're 59 graduating from the part of the school I'm affiliated with. And I just shared with them that back at my high school graduation, we were many, many decades ago, we were assembled for rehearsal, and one of the teachers got our attention for a minute, and she said, you need to know that this is likely the ceremony that would come up the next day, that this is likely the last time you will ever be together as a group, that this will likely be the very last time. And my mind was on go-kart engines. My mind was on maybe going off to college. It was on a lot of other things. But that struck me, thinking, you think that's right? And I thought, maybe it was. And sure enough, within a few years after that time, there were some from our class of just 100 that had passed away and were no longer with us. And just this idea of the short nature of our lives, and we don't know yet. It's daily. We need to make this choice daily. We need to come to terms with it. And so Elijah challenged them with that. But the people's response was to be silent. They didn't say anything. They may have been like me as a high school student about to graduate, thinking, really? Is that the case or not? And you think about what kept them from responding, that mass silence that was there, whether it was peer pressure or saying, I just don't know yet. What I'm getting at is I want us to be mindful of not being paralyzed in the same way like they are, that we need to know that, I mean, this could be our last gathering of this group, that we might not ever be together. We just don't have a guarantee for the future. And we've got to come to grips with, what are we going to believe? What are we going to do? How are we going to live? And that's what Elijah was trying to drive the folks for. So I think I'm jumping right past 26. But at noon. So I think I'm jumping past a few verses there. You know what was going on when Elijah told the folks to go and take two bulls to offer a sacrifice, for them to call on their God to see if he would bring fire down to take it. That wasn't happening. They'd set out the bull, but it had not been burned up. And at noon, Elijah begins to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is a God. Perhaps he's deep in thought or busy or traveling. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. And they shouted louder and slashed themselves with the swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time of the evening sacrifice. That picture of these folks calling on Baal or calling on Asherah to try and intervene, and it goes on hour after hour after hour after hour, just wearing themselves out. And he is pushing at them, trying to force the issue, trying to make it as apparent as can be that there's no answer. And he waits until the time of the evening sacrifice. They've had all day long for their God to answer. And it comes to the time of the normal evening sacrifice. There'd been no response. No one answered. And no one paid attention. And Elijah said, come here to me. They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been on Mount Carmel, which had been torn down under King Ahab. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, your name will be Israel. He didn't have to rebuild the altar that way. You know, he didn't have to do that, but he's taking time, I think, to make a point that this is tied to your heritage. This is tied that I'm going to use this altar that was used to worship God. I'm going to take time to put these 12 stones, reminding you of the tribes of Israel that God has watched out for. And just think, you know, sometimes maybe we need to be mindful, use some physical reminders, and we do at times. A number of you have wedding rings on your fingers. Those are a physical reminder of a covenant that we individually make. Some have a cross around their neck as a reminder of who we believe in and what he has done. Elijah was using this physical reminder there. And with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug the trench around it, and he arranged the wood. He cut the bull into pieces, laid it on the wood, and then he told folks to fill 4 jars of water and pour it over the offering of the wood. Asked them, after they'd done 4 big jars of water, he asked them to do it again, and then he asked them to do it a third time, and they did. And the water ran down in this trench around that was filled up. I don't know who it was that got those jars of water. We don't think there are other prophets that are there of God. We think Elijah was standing alone as a prophet of God. So I don't know if these were some of the prophets of Baal, if there were some of the king's servants. I'm just curious about who was doing that. And if they were the prophets of Baal, were they thinking, we're going to soak this thing really good? You know, we're gonna make sure. Just interesting to see. And at the time of the sacrifice, the prophet Elijah steps forward and he prays, Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I'm your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you, Lord, our God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. What short prayer, such a short prayer. What are the key elements that you see in that prayer? What's Elijah saying that really strikes you? And it's because God, who's in control, told him to. That he's a servant of God, and that God is sovereign. That he is making it clear, this isn't me who's about to make this happen. This is all God who's making this happen. And the peace that God wants to be known and wants the people to turn back to him. These people that have rebelled against him, these people that wouldn't choose him, they want to turn back to him. It's powerful to see. And then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, burned up the sacrifice, burned up the wood, burned up the stones, burned up the water, in the trench. And you think about all that was in that scene that was left. Just envision for a moment what, if you were there, what would you be smelling? What would you be seeing? Maybe there's the unburnt sacrifice, that bull that's been out all day, the pieces, the smell of blood, the smell of flies, whatever that's there. The false prophets that are all around, they've been cut, they are worn out, they've been working hard but haven't been able to do anything. The king, I don't know where King Ahab was at this point, but having a bad day. And then a different smell where there's a charred spot where there used to be stone and there used to be water and there used to be a bull. Yeah. And Elijah, just certain. Yeah. More confident for a moment than ever about the power of his God and perhaps this moment of silence. Then everybody cries out that the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. I may have lost control again, yeah. And you think about how quiet they were earlier when no one would speak and Elijah challenged them, and now all of a sudden they're able to answer that challenge without question. But just closing out, think about how, if any way, was this story similar to that opening story of the window? Do you see any similarities between those? Folks working under a perception that was false. They did not recognize God as being real. And then this moment when it's an undeniable truth that God's real. And this knowledge that there'll come a time for every human that's ever lived when we will all bow, every knee will bow, and every tongue confess. Yeah, undeniable truth. It's just a question of if we do it now or not. And about the lessons for us to make our choice about God. A key thing for us to take away, I think, and I'll end with this thought, is just this thought that we need to work to be sure our perceptions align with the truth. We need to try and not live under a delusion or under a lie. And part of that is just spending time in His Word, of praying and asking for Him to open our hearts and trying to make sure that we really are following His will. This story about Elijah and the prophets of Baal always kind of, it strikes me. It's more said there's more to the story later on to follow up on. But it is powerful, but encourage you to take time in His Word with stories like that. And we got a special guest out there who's going to be with us today, Timmy Pauley. Thank y'all for participating. See you next. Well, I'll be gone the next 2 weeks to Honduras, but Hurt will be teaching, so you'll have a really good class.